May it please the court.
Yes, you may proceed.
Your Honors, in our appeal, we have raised constitutional issues concerning Section 538200 of the Missouri Revised Statutes. We contend that it violates the Constitution of the State of Missouri in Article 1, Section 32, is the right to trial by jury. In Article 2, Section 1, the separation of powers doctrine. Article 1, Section 26, taking private property without just compensation. And Article 3, Section 44, that it's a special law. With regard to the first, the right to trial by jury, our position that the statute violates the both the reasoning in Watts v. Lester E. Cox Medical Center, because it deprives the plaintiff or the judgment creditor of immediately enforcing his judgment. It deprives that by ordering periodic payments and installment payments when over $100,000, which means you can't immediately enforce your judgment, but you have to wait to collect. It forces the plaintiff to assume risk that he may never collect. It's not uncommon to have insurance companies go under. It's not uncommon for people to die. If a doctor were to die,
Did the legislature counter that risk by authorizing bond or surety to protect against that risk?
That doesn't protect it for the simple reason that the the bond or surety, again, you have to wait to get it, and if the plaintiff were to die before the time, it actually takes part of the judgment away from him.
But that's a different issue than whether periodic payments are legitimate.
But the mere fact that you have to wait to collect in and of itself violates a lot of different sections of the Constitution. And did I answer your question? I don't know if I did.
You did. Okay. Thank you.
I think opposing counsel argues that it's the judgment that you're entitled to collect, and the judgment is entered with periodic payments, and that resolves the problem.
Yes, but the judgment has to be based on the verdict. The judge cannot change the verdict in any way, shape, or form.
So if it reduces it, but is there a difference between saying the verdict is reduced versus saying if you're made whole by getting interest or by having a bond and so forth, how does it violate the principle that you get everything the jury awarded?
Well, it does it in a couple of ways. One of the ways it does it is when you put on a trial such as this, generally you have to reduce any future damages down to present value. That reduction is usually done at about a 3-5% based on inflation. When you reduce it down and then you get this judgment entered like this, you can only collect 1% back,
and
so you lose.
And that's an argument which was addressed in Watts that says that if you're not made whole, if you get less than the jury awarded, if the two interest rates are inconsistent. But that's a different question than the first one you raised, which is inherently periodic payments are bad even if you're made whole, even if interest is allowed such that you're made whole eventually, you're saying it still violates it.
It's still a violation.
In other words, you're making two different arguments, I believe. Tell me if I'm incorrect. One is that the interest rates, the way it's set up, you never get what the jury awarded you. And the second is, and the one you first argued here, is that even if you did, you shouldn't have to wait. And I'm wondering why, as long as you're made whole, that's a violation, the fact that you had to wait to collect some.
It's a violation because it undercuts and ignores and violates the jury's determination of damages. The jury determined what the damages were. The jury didn't say, you're only going to get this over time. That's something that the legislature came in and imposed on the courts and says, you know, we're a super juror, and this is the way you're going to have to do it. We can cancel out what the jury in the trial said, that you're entitled to X amount of dollars, and say, and the long history of case law where we have right to immediate execution on a judgment, they say, no, you don't anymore. You're going to be spread out over this time, so they're altering what the jury did. This isn't a judgment based on a jury verdict. This is a judgment based on what the legislature said the verdict should be. And that goes then into the separation of power argument, but it ends up making the jury only an advisory jury.
One of the arguments you make is that the formula in the statute for the payment of the periodic payments does not make your client whole, because your client may incur future medical expenses not according to the legislature's formula. Could you address that issue?
Sure. Just take an example of say a doctor was insured with what used to be PIE insurance, and PIE insurance goes bankrupt. They've already made two payments, but there's still the doctor there. Before the third payment comes due, the doctor passes away. Under this plan and under this scheme, Mr. Tharp has no right to go in and make a claim against the estate at that point, because nothing is due and owing at that point. It's not due and owing until he makes it alive to this point in time. That's how it violates it. It basically says, we, the legislature, are going to enter for the health care provider a satisfaction of judgment, even when the entire judgment has not been paid.
How does your argument that, the way I understand your argument is that the legislature can't do anything that affects the judgment after the fact. But how does that coincide with the fact that we've held the statutory right of remittitor and additor to be constitutional?
Those are two different things. This is the legislature saying, yes, it will be that. With regard to remittitor and additor, it's up to the party to decide whether they're going to accept it.
And what Watts said is that was recognized at common law as an exception, that you had a right to trial by jury and the jury to determine damages, but the common law recognized remittitor. It's also judicial, not legislative, remittitor.
Well, I understand, but in remittitor...
And you have the option of a new trial. You don't have to accept it.
In remittitor, the party has the option to make the decision. The party says, I'm not going to accept remittitor. I'll take my chances on appeal, or I will accept it. Or the same with the additor. Here, you don't get any choice. This is what it is. This is what the legislature says the verdict is going to be, the judgment is going to be. It infringes upon the power of the courts to do that, but it also violates the constitutional right to jury trial, because the jury never said that. The jury said this is what you're entitled to, and every judgment must be based on the verdict by the jury.
I assume other states have statutes allowing for future periodic payments. Is there any other case law? I didn't see anything in the briefs from other states that have found that type of statute to be to violate a person's right to a trial by jury.
I did not research that, to be honest, but I can tell you from reading over the years that there are states that have done that, that have done it. But I can't cite them to you, and I can't quote them, and I don't want to be held to that. Okay. But then, with regard to the separation of powers, this is not an issue that's been before this court at the time, but it applies when one branch of government impermissibly interferes with another's performance of his powers, or when one branch assumes power more properly entrusted to the other. And Section 538.220 violates both of those. A judgment is a quintessential function of the court. That's always been the judiciary, never been the legislature. But here, it interferes with the power in that, with the jury verdict, by forcing the trial judge to enter a judgment that it materially differs from the verdict. It alters the fundamental right to immediate enforcement of a valid judgment. It declares the legislature has the power to set a cap on future medical damages if a plaintiff dies before collecting. Precludes the court from further enforcement of judgments. Nowhere during the course of this, in the example that I use, the insurance company goes broke, there's no bond set, because they only set a bond if there's not enough insurance. Well, you can be in court and say, I've got $5 million insurance. The judgment's entered, and 5 days later, the insurance company files for receivership or goes bankrupt.
Counsel, before your time is up, I'd like you to address the issue on the cross appeal issue on credentialing, and what are the elements of a negligent credentialing cause of action, and do they require proof of lack of competence by the person?
It does not. Their focus is wrong. The focus isn't on the doctor in a negligent credentialing case. The focus is on the surgery center, the hospital. The reason that is it's a negligent credentialing. It's not a negligence performance. To prove that case, you've got to prove that the doctor committed malpractice, which we did and wasn't even opposed to trial on that. What we're proving is that the surgery center was negligent in what it did. It has an obligation under state law to adopt and abide by its own rules and regulations, and state law doesn't even...
Well, are you in effect saying it's negligence per se to violate the regulations
No.
governing hiring?
Well, not negligence per se. I'm not arguing that the law does, but it's evidence of negligence. That is evidence that they didn't use proper due care and didn't fulfill a duty that they have to the public, because the duty to the public comes from the Code of State Regulations, section?
I noticed that one of the cases you cite, the only case I know of to address this, a Court of Appeals case from Missouri, I think it's Taylor Lee versus Pulitzer Publishing Company, relies on the restatement of tort section 411, and some other states follow that also. But that seems to require you to show that the person you hired was not competent, and it was your negligence in failing to discover that lack of competence that ended up leading to the person having the opportunity to be negligent.
In the states where this has been decided, no state has said you have to prove the doctor's incompetent. No state has said that. You have to prove the doctor incompetent. You have to prove the doctor's disqualified. And what disqualified the doctor is not completing honestly and accurately an application to be admitted to the medical staff, and that is the duty. And
I found cases going both ways. So assuming those exist, why is one a better policy than the other?
But, you know, how do you prove incompetence? I mean, that's an impossibility. Who's going to say this doctor's totally incompetent? You'd have to go back through all of his cases, all of his surgeries, or at least for the last period of time, and say, well, yeah, I've looked at this, and he's an incompetent doctor. You can't, that's an impossible burden to prove. What you need to prove is you got to focus on the facility. And the facility has requirements. And it's not a negligence per se requirement, but it does say, the state law says you will have these policies and procedures, and you will abide by them. They have the policies and the procedures, and the policy and procedures quite clear. If somebody omits material information...
So you're saying it's not necessary, but it is sufficient to show they violated their bylaws. It's not necessary, but it is sufficient to show they violated their bylaws.
You have to show the physician to show they violated, they were incompetent, they violated their own bylaws, they violated the...
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. McIntosh, you're out of time on your initial part of your argument, but we're going to give you your full time for rebuttal anyway. You don't have to. We've never criticized lawyers for not using all of their time.
Keep that in mind, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court?
You may proceed.
So I guess the first thing that I would point out is that this isn't the first time that this issue has been in front of the Court. In fact, the issue was first raised quite some time ago in the Adams case. It certainly wasn't squarely within the arguments that are being made today. But in the Adams case, the plaintiff did, in fact, argue that Section 538 was unconstitutional and particularly violated the right to a jury trial. Now, this court at that time held that, in fact, that 538 generally passed constitutional muster, and that it did not, in fact, interfere with the right to jury trial. Obviously, in the Watts case, the court turned around on Section 210 of the statute and found that, in fact, the damage cap that was in that section was unconstitutional as a violation of the right to a jury trial. However, in that case, the plaintiff also argued that, in fact, that Section 222 was also unconstitutional and that it violated both the due process and the equal protection clauses of the Missouri Constitution. And in response to that, the court, in fact, while taking away 210 and finding it to be unconstitutional, found that once again that 220 did pass constitutional muster. It did challenge, as Judge Jemberseth was arguing earlier, it did challenge this concept of the amount of interest as between reducing to present value versus the interest that's allowed in 220 for the periodic payments, and in fact returned it to the court for a determination of that issue. But the statute itself was allowed to stand. And so that's the first thing I would say, is that this is an issue that's has been revisited by the court, and so far has passed constitutional muster. We think that the current claims by plaintiff have actually shouldn't lead this court in a different direction. I think it still passes constitutional muster because I think this is a well thought out statute. I think that it addresses potential issues with changing the verdict to include these periodic payments, and really changing a verdict is probably a poor way to say that. But
Watts didn't address the right to trial by jury.
Right. The Watts did not address the right to trial by jury in the 220. It had to do with the equal protection and the due process.
Well, Watts addressed the right to trial by jury, that you have the right to the damages the jury awarded. It didn't address any of the other aspects of it.
Right. It addressed the right to jury trial in the 210, so in the damage cap,
right,
and the right to the damages. But yeah, as to 220 itself, it focused on the because again, the plaintiff's argument focused on the equal protection clause as well as due process clause. So, as we move forward today, I want to just address a couple of the things, I guess, that were raised in the first argument here. The first of that is whether or not this statute actually does protect against bankruptcy or mismanagement of funds. Again, our position is that it is. The fact that a surety or a bond can be allowed is built into the statute to protect against just such circumstances. Plaintiff's counsel had indicated that that's only the case if there's insufficient insurance, and I would gently disagree with counsel. I would say that in fact that there's an evidentiary hearing that can be requested by the parties, and so at that point, should the plaintiff have evidence that however the judgment is being paid out is in danger from either mismanagement, from bankruptcy, or their other issues, those could be presented at that hearing, and that a court has full discretion to order that the defendant put a bond in, put in a surety.
About the provision that says that if the injured party dies prior to receiving all the money, that they will not be paid the additional monies which they're owed? Why isn't that a reduction of the jury's verdict?
Well, I would say a couple of things to that is the first is that the jury verdict, the periodic payments of the jury's verdict goes only to future medical bills that are going to be assessed by the plaintiff. And in the first instance, the lifespan of the plaintiff can actually be taken into consideration by the court.
And that is, it's also taken into consideration by the jury in deciding how much damages to award. You've argued that, well, for them to get damages for years they in fact are deceased and are not going to live is a windfall. But in fact, what you're saying is the jury gave them too much money, so we're going to reduce what the jury gave. And yet you don't give more if they live longer than what the jury was told was the lifespan. So how are you not interfering with the jury's verdict?
Right, and I think that for that, I do think that it's the windfall argument rests on the bills that are actually being incurred actually are paid.
But the jury didn't award whatever your future bills are. They awarded a certain amount, and you're changing it to whatever the future bills are. Can you address more directly why that's not just what Watts said was improper in a different context?
I think that it's because the way that it's done through the periodic payments, it it takes into consideration the lifespan. And you're right that the jury takes into consideration the evidence as well. In fact, the trial judge is ordered to take into consideration the experts from the plaintiff's side, the plaintiff's evidence as to what their anticipated lifespan is. And so the idea that the jury is encompassing here is making sure that they have sufficient medical bills to last their lifetime. And
I understand why it seems fair in some sense that you just get the money for future medicals if you actually incur them. But in dealing with the question of interfering with the right to jury trial, that's really a different issue. And I'm not sure your argument goes to that.
Well, and there, I think, too, the other thing that you have to address is the fact that here, there's no evidence that, based on the medical injury that the plaintiff suffered, that he would die within the 5 years that the periodic payments are ordered to be made.
And in so, that sense, it's speculative, but would it be right. too late and you'd say you waived it if you didn't raise it now, as opposed to waiting till if they did die? Wouldn't one say that it's final and it's too late? I would appreciate, really, I'm not sure how one deals with that.
As to whether it would be too late.
Well, if you're saying now we don't know if it's going to apply to him, so we shouldn't throw anything out because of that. But when we would know, say he died in 3 years, by then the judgment's final and you couldn't go back. So is there ever an opportunity to address that issue?
Well, again, if there was a determination, I suppose that even if it came after the jury's verdict, if there was a determination that he was in fact going to die earlier, that could be presented at the evidence you're hearing at the close of the case.
Thank you. I don't want to take all your time on that.
So I guess that's what I would say is that it's still, what we're dealing with is a speculative case is almost understating it. It really is not an anticipated event. So it's not as though the medical damages that were suffered by the plaintiff are leading to an earlier death that's not taken into consideration. Instead, what you're talking about is would almost be, you know, the instance where he were to be in a car accident and to die. And so what we're talking about is a fairly outside chance of something happening within that 5 years, where there's no indication in the evidence that his medical damages are leading to that danger.
Could you address the issue of whether the statutory provisions for surety and interest make the plaintiff whole in the periodic payments? Because they might well, if in fact all the plaintiff needed was monitoring and you had regular payments over time, but if in fact the plaintiff needs significant surgery, that they might need that significant surgery sooner than later in the periodic payments. So how in fact do they have the full benefit of that jury award for future medical benefits under the legislature's periodic payment?
So the first thing I would say is that the trial court has the discretion to take that into consideration, meaning that the legislature does not require that there be equal payments over the time period. And so if there is actually evidence that was entered at trial or evidence entered in the hearing afterwards that there was an immediate need for medical bills and then say, you know, like an immediate surgery and then later monitoring.
If in fact that was known at the time and there could
right.
be that evidence, but that always isn't predictable. So there was evidence as to the potential for needing a liver transplant. So what if that occurred earlier in the time period instead of later, and there were not sufficient funds that were payable under the periodic terms of the trial court's order?
Well, and again, on that, what I would say, Your Honor, is that the chance of the needing a liver transplant at evidence was that it was 1% chance, a 1% likelihood that would happen. Also, there would, again, if there were evidence that there was an indication that could be earlier.
And I use that as an example. It could be just
right.
the repeat surgery to correct the non-functioning bile duct, which also would be a major expense.
Right, and that's, I would say, here, that's a difficult question to answer because we don't have evidence regarding the costs associated with those secondary injuries.
And has that ever been required in prior cases?
To my knowledge, it has not been required in prior cases, but that's not an independent issue that I researched. And so, but again, I would say that it here, I mean, the court has the discretion to address the evidence that was entered at trial in determining the periodic payments. And so here, there simply was no evidence that there was going to be a secondary injury. There was no evidence as to what the cost of that secondary injury would have been. And so there was simply not evidence that would support the judge front-loading this payment. I would also say that here the judge ordered periodic payments over 5 years, even though there wasn't any evidence that the plaintiff was, you know, expected to die within 5 years. And so he's not getting these strung out over a 50-year time span or 25-year time span that would be more like what his anticipated lifespan would be, but then in fact the way that the judge did these periodic payments effectively did front load in this case. And so, because I only have a few minutes left, I do want to touch on our cross-respondent's brief, and again to address the comments that were made during the opening argument. I would say here that I would agree that the focus should be on the Surgis Center and what they did in order to qualify this doctor and to credential this doctor. But at the end of the day, what the argument here is that they negligently credentialed a competent physician. And I think that in the cases that I've looked at, and I agree with Judge Zenver-Stith that there are some cases out there where states have gone the other direction, but in general, when you look at this issue, to say that this was a doctor who had performed 4,000 of these procedures with 2 error rates, that's well below the national average for conducting this kind of a surgery, and to say that because they violated a bylaw, because the procedure that they used in credentialing him had a flaw in it, that in itself creates a negligent credentialing case, I think loses the heart of what a negligent credentialing case is.
And what is it? This court's never defined it, said what the elements might be, or formally adopted it. So should we follow Section 411? Is there some common law rule that's appropriate? What are the elements?
I think that what the court can look at is the prior cases here in Missouri that we gave you 2 cases, where really, again, the focus is on whether or not the result of the credentialing process was putting an unqualified physician in a position to provide care to patients.
And is there, I mean, the key thing you all seem to disagree about on this particular issue is whether it has to be, you have to prove you hired an incompetent contractor or physician, or whether you have to prove that they were competent. So what do we look to determine whether that's an element, and how often is it made an element versus not made an element in other states?
So it's more often in the other states, in the cases that I found, more often that they do require a showing that there was competency. Again, I think that there is, in all of those cases, the general understanding that a physician being negligent in a particular case is simply insufficient to show negligent credentialing. And so pairing together a flaw in the negligent credentialing procedure with a flaw in the, or a, you know, that a finding of negligence in this particular instance is insufficient.
I think opposing counsel's argument is you have to prove they're negligent in credentialing the person, and it might be the only way to prove that is to prove you hired an incompetent person, but here they set out certain requirements for hiring in their bylaws and failed to follow them, and that's an alternative way to prove it.
Right, except that here, where, again, even though they didn't follow the strict letter of the bylaws, the information that those bylaws were intended to provide to the credentialing body, meaning the lawsuits that they'd been involved in, the credentialing body also goes to additional steps to determine what, in other words, what the prior lawsuits were. So by going to the national database and checking, you know, and having a company check for them, you know, who he actually, or what lawsuits he was involved in, they actually garnered a lot more information on those lawsuits than they would have even asked for in the application itself.
Yeah, see, that sounds to me like causation. It's not that incompetence is an element of the tort. It's that incompetence is how you establish causation between the negligent act, the failure to enforce the bylaws, and the harm, which is the death of the plaintiff.
Right, and to some degree I would agree with you that it really is, because the question is, I mean, what negligent credentialing is providing the auspices of the hospital and telling the general public this is a competent physician, right? That's what privileges mean. And so the negligent credentialing is the concept that you're doing that and but yet holding out an incompetent physician. And it's not like incompetence is some kind of amorphous thing that can't be determined. I mean, the cases that have found it have looked to lack of training. They've looked to, you know, lack of education, lack of, or particular issues with procedures, you know, a showing of actual incompetence in the past. And so if in fact the result of the credentialing process is that a competent physician conducted the surgery on the plaintiff, then where is the harm? I mean,
do the bylaws attach significance to a physician providing false information that is separate and distinct from their ability to know what the not produced evidence is? And you're focusing on, well, they can find that information somewhere else, as opposed to the significance of a physician providing false information.
Right, and I would say two things to that. One is that I would agree with you that to a certain degree it is, there's a second element of honesty. Here, again, that's information that the credentialing body had when they made the decision to go ahead and credential this doctor, because again, they had determined whether he had completed this application in full or not, you know, with complete and accurate information or not.
I mean, that's not disputed, is it?
Right.
That he did
right.
Not.
Yeah, it's not disputed that. Yeah.
I mean, you're saying they knew that when they credentialed him.
Right. They knew what his application said, and they had the national database with all the information on his lawsuits. Both of those documents.
Well, they knew about some of them. They didn't know about all of them, but they knew about some additional
ones. They knew about some of them. What they didn't know about was they had not done the CaseNet search to come up with these 22 lawsuits. We actually don't know anything about what those lawsuits are because that wasn't entered into evidence, and so we don't know whether those ended up in results or not. The national database, the reason that the credentialing bodies go to that national database is because they look at and report on cases with results, so they try to capture in that not just, you know, some doctors get sued more because of the type of work that they do, but that it's
how many did he say he had? Zero cases where he had settled or had a judgment entered against him.
He said that he named three cases on the application.
He said that none of them resulted in. And what was the evidence that it was between 7 and 9?
Yeah, I think it was between 7 and 9. And I don't remember how many of those off the top of my head ended up in judgments. The second thing I would say very briefly, Judge Breckenridge, is that there is an understanding in these surgery centers and with the physicians that they're going to be going to the national databank. And so I think that to a certain degree, they didn't view this as the doctor being dishonest or making any actual attempt to hide the lawsuits that had been filed against him, because it's such standard practice for this kind of a search to be done. He also would have known that they would have certainly gone to the other, you know, credentialing bodies and talked to them. And so, you know, I think that the way that they were looking at it, again, here was just that this wasn't that he was, you know, going out of his way to try and hide things or to be dishonest, that if anything, it was probably more an error of, you know, just going through the form too quickly or having somebody else fill out the form for him.
Counselor, you're out of time.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
With regard to that, it seems that their argument is that, well, we really don't have to worry about credentialing. They might make a few mistakes here and there, but the doctor still gets to practice. The bottom line in this case with the surgery center was the reason he was allowed to continue to practice is because he was generating a large amount of income, approximately $2 million a year for the surgery center. They, you know, over a period of time, the five-year period, it was well over $10 million. That, I think, was the consideration. Their own bylaws require that it shall be in writing submitted on forms prescribed by the Credentials Committee with all of the provisions completed accurately, truthfully, and signed by the applicant, and the applicant shall be given a copy of these bylaws and all modifications.
But to go to the causation question raised by Judge Wilson, if he had answered that honestly and had mentioned all his lawsuits, there's no evidence here that would have made any difference to the credentialing decision, is there?
If he'd have done that.
No, I thought the evidence was they knew about it and they hired him anyway. I mean, if you had evidence of that, but I didn't think there was evidence that it would have changed their credentialing decision.
Well, how can you say? You're looking back and you don't know. That's speculation. If they were on a credentialing committee and they're looking and saying, well, you know, this guy told us he had four, but he's got 22, I think it might make a difference in their credentialing. But here...
Well, let's suppose that they had that regulation and they didn't even require this doctor to do an application. He just walks in, off the street, they say, great, you're credentialed.
Yeah.
Is that negligence?
Yeah, that's negligence.
But suppose he has an absolutely clean record. He's never been sued. He's the greatest doctor you or I ever saw. Now, how is that still negligence?
Well, you've never been sued.
How does that cause the harm to the plaintiff?
What caused the harm to the plaintiff is this doctor shouldn't have been allowed to...
He was
performed the surgery. One, and this is a St. Luke's system, and St. Luke's has a list of doctors that they refer their patients to. This is a doctor that was on the St. Luke's list that he got referred to.
Didn't the bylaws say he shouldn't have been hired if he failed to?
That's exactly what they say.
So is that the causation then, that he would never have been a doctor at St. Luke's and
that's
this
right.
surgery would never happen?
Yep.
But that's a cause in fact, but is it a proximate cause or is it a pulse graft kind of cause? Yet without that fact happening, he never would have ended up being in the surgery, but it didn't actually, nothing about his violation of the bylaws actually was the proximate cause of the injury.
Well,
it was just one of the antecedent necessary facts.
If that was the burden, we would never be able to prove negligent credentialing case because you would never be able to prove that what the hospital did caused the doctor's hand to go to the wrong place.
So you're saying that if, in fact, he had revealed all his lawsuits and he was hired anyway, you would not have a negligent credentialing claim here?
What's that now?
So you would not have a negligent credentialing claim here if, in fact, he had revealed all his lawsuits?
If he'd revealed them all, they had researched them all and had arrived at an independent decision that even though he's had all these suits, he's still permitted to practice here. No, we would not have a negligent credentialing, but they didn't do any of that. And their bylaws are clear. He shall be automatically removed. They don't even get a choice. It's automatic. You're off. They didn't do that. But no, if they had done everything, researched everything, did what they were supposed to do, and then the doctor just commits malpractice, it's a malpractice suit. But here you put a doctor in a position to where he could commit malpractice when he shouldn't have been in that position. He should have never been allowed in that position.
Counselor, you're out of time. Thank you.
Emma, okay.
It was a well-argued case.
All right, thank you much.